This spoiler-filled podcast is recorded live, unscripted, and intended for those over 18. Now prepare your ears for the audio stimulation they've been waiting for all day as we step into
the spoiler room.
We are doing another episode of the spoiler room. I am your host, as always, Mark the Movie Man. I appreciate everyone who's been listening in. We do have some consistent listeners out there. Thank you so much for subscribing. And don't forget, when you're listening to us on iTunes, to comment and rate as well. We all appreciate it, as well as feedback. And tonight, on the Spoiler Room, because I saw him pop up on Netflix Instant View and I said, what the hell? Tonight we're going to be talking about the two Richard Chamberlain, Alan Quatermain films that came out in the mid-80s. That's right, King Solomon's Mines and Alan Quatermain and the Lost City of Gold. And tonight, to help me plow through these wonderful retro bits of nostalgia, we have in here tonight, we have the big fucking deal himself, Mr. Glenn Bittner. How are you tonight, sir?
That would be the lost big fucking deal.
The Lost.
Although you can see me, just like apparently everyone can see the Lost City. I'm good.
You're not supposed to notice that. And also joining us tonight is Mr. Scott Davis. How are you doing, sir? The movies affected you that much, huh? That's right, it's the three amigos of the spoiler room tonight. You just have us, which tells you just how popular these films really are.
About as popular as they were when they were released, really.
Probably. So the first one tonight we're going to talk about is the first one out of the pair, and that's King Solomon's Mines from 1985. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar, Alan Quatermain, who is actually a literary character from a famous series of adventure books from, I believe it is, the early 1900s, late 1800s.
Late 1800s, H. Yes. Haggard,
And it's about fortune hunter Alan Quatermain, only the movie is the fortune hunter Alan Quatermain teams up with a resourceful woman to help find her missing father lost in the wilds of 1900s Africa while being pursued by hostile tribes and a rival German explorer. Now, that makes it sound interesting. Fortunately, that's not quite the film you do get with King Solomon's Mines. Now, it wasn't well received when it came out, but it does have some big names in here. You've got Richard Chamberlain as Alan Quatermain, and yes, a very young Sharon Stone in here. You got Herbert Lohm. You've got John Rhys Davies in here, who just had gotten off of Temple of Doom, and he went and did this. Guys, let's open it up to you. We'll start with Glenn. What'd you think of King Solomon's Mines?
Oh, my God. So, obviously, you know, when they made this, they had obviously seen Temple of Doom.
Yeah.
And was it Gary Nelson as a director, I believe?
The first was J. Lee Thompson.
J. Lee Thompson
was this one, yeah, the one who did Cape Fear.
Yeah, and two Planet of the Apes films.
He and whoever the casting director was says, you know, Kate Upshaw was not whiny enough in Temple of Doom. We need someone who whines even more. So they got Sharon Stone. My gosh. I do not advocate violence against women, but oh my, you know, if I could reach through my TV, I would have slapped her one because she was every 4 seconds whining, why, hey, Quatermain. I'll say that, you know, at least compared to the second movie, this is a strong showing. So.
That is very true, and you don't really realize it till you watch them back to back.
Yes.
Mr. Scott Davis, what about you? Initial reaction to King Solomon's Mines?
When I was 10 years old, my initial reaction was, wow, this is really cheap and cheesy knockoff. And now it's, wow, this is a really cheap and cheesy knockoff, but I'm digging it. See, I was into all these adventure-type things back then. I even had the old VCR game, Doorways to Adventure. So, I mean, anything that had, like, this was, like, one of these Indiana Jones knockoffs like this, Treasure of the Four Crowns, High Road to China, I was into it. this, yeah, I get what, to just address what Glenn's saying, yeah, absolutely. I remember seeing this movie and immediately saying, well, this Sharon Stone girl, she can't act her way out of tall grass. Yeesh. She's never going to have a career after this, you know? And I was wrong, unfortunately, but I don't think she was quite as bad as Kate Capshaw in Temple of Doom, but she was certainly in that general vicinity, because I think Kate Capshaw is the weak point of all four Indiana Jones films. It's the worst thing in all of them. And Sharon Stone is, yeah, she obviously was trying to be like that. I can't say I liked her. But I did keep, every time I saw it, I just said, at least she's not Kate Capshaw.
Well, now you do have to give her, this was one of her first features. She had been in a couple of minor roles before this. You did a few TV things, mm-hmm. but she was still an up-and-coming actress, so part of it had to be the direction and writing as well. The script was written by the same guy who brought us Police Academy 3, 4, and 5. He'd also go on, yeah, he'd also go on to write The Lost City of Gold. Plus, he did Loaded Weapon 1. And, yeah, I'm surprised this guy still was able to do work from 88 to 2004, though he didn't do much.
And let's not forget, the first thing that Sharon Stone did after these two movies was Police Academy 4.
Yes. It is. Citizen on Patrol, which actually isn't a bad movie. But King Solomon's Mines, yeah, I enjoyed this one quite a bit when I was younger. Actually, I got a kick out of it that it was tongue-in-cheek, poke fun at the indie films who, you know, Temple of Doom had just finished, I think, the year before. So when this came out, it was like, oh, yeah, this is entertaining. Plus, it was cable fodder. I mean, King Solomon's Mines for a while was on heavy rotation on a number of movie cable back when cable was still sprouting and new and they were looking for programming.
Especially Showtime and Movie Channel, because they had an exclusive contract with Canon at the time. Mm-hmm. So all the Canon films were exclusive to Showtime and the Movie Channel for at least about 5 years or so. And so every time King Solomon's Mines or some Michael Dudikoff movie came on, they made it sound like it was freaking Star Wars. Like, Michael Dudikoff, the new one, only here. I'm like, well, you know, no one really else cares.
Canon came out with fun films. Canon came out with highly produced films, but some of those films were a lot of fun.
I love Canon.
You know, and what I found interesting with this is that King Solomon's Mines actually is distributed by Paramount Pictures.
Yeah!
Which blew my mind, because, Indiana Jones, and I'm like, wow, the first one was distributed by Paramount Pictures, and I'm like,
I meant to dig
crazy.
That up, because it wasn't distributed by them in this country.
Initially. No.
But I saw like their logo on there. I'm like, do they own the rights to this now? And I didn't know if they knew own the rights to it now, or if they did it, or if they released it like theatrically overseas, because some of these things had different distributors or what. But yeah, my eyebrows just about shot right off my head too when I saw that.
Well, they did. I think they did have a relationship with Glenn Gulbius. Who helped produce this film.
Glenn Gulbius, yeah.
Now, I want to get at this. So we talk about the links with this early. I mean, Alan, you know, Indiana Jones was influenced by Alan Quatermain, so then we have Alan Quatermain movies coming out after Indiana Jones, though this is actually the third Alan Quatermain film to be released. There were two more before this in King Solomon's Mines, a 1937 one, I believe, and a 1950s one. And the 50s one, I guess, is very well received.
It's great. Yeah. I love that movie.
This one, not so much. But what I found interesting with King Solomon's Mines, and I want to get your guys' take on it, it was really kind of surreal to see John Rhys Davies in this film, who just came off of Indiana Jones, and he's playing a villain in this film, and playing it quite well, actually. I think he is one of the shining points in this film. What did you think of Sala's role in this film, Glenn?
I mean, it doesn't surprise me that he's in it. I mean, he's not, even though he was in, you know, Indiana Jones films, he was not a huge star.
Mm-hmm.
So, him being in this, I mean, that didn't surprise me at all. And he plays a good villain. He really does.
Yeah, I loved his villain. I mean, I was like, wow, he's really selling this role when I'm watching it. Scott, what about you? Did you think
He's a good character actor, and I think that this film was filled with both these films were filled with character actors that you appreciate. And you know, let's face it, you know, John Rhys-Davies, yeah, he wasn't. I mean, he's been able to be in everything from Lord of the Rings to down to this and stuff. But you know, let's face it, if you're Sliders material, you're also Canon material. So he's a. So, no, I thought he was good. He didn't even have to take a bath in between sets, you know? And, I thought he did a damn... I thought he was probably the best villain in there. I thought he was a lot less tongue-in-cheek than Herbert Lom's villain in this film.
So, oh, God.
Yeah. Okay, apparently not a lot of love for Herbert Lom.
Not in this movie.
No. Colonel Bachner, who listened to Wagner, and... Herbert Lom, you know, you get an experienced actor, and you give him this role. Scott, you mentioned him. What did you think of Herbert Lom's role? I mean, he's an experienced. I mean, this is a really experienced actor that you get in this film. That's this kind of cheesy. Well, not kind of. This is extremely campy, cheesy,
yeah.
Tongue-in-cheek. You know, poke fun not only at Indiana Jones but a literary character itself. What'd you think of that? Them putting him in that role.
These films were full of campy characters, and of course, his character is not in the original movie. You know, it's the whole thing. I mean, even they updated it and everything. And he was Colonel Klink in it, guys. Come on, he was totally. I mean, would you have even blinked if at one point he just said, "I see nothing"? You know, no, you wouldn't have, because that's totally what he was doing here. These things had a lot of humor, a lot of campiness. It's something that really annoyed me when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't really... When I saw this, King Solomon's Mines, I was surprised how much more I liked it than when I was a kid. I mean, I was a lot more forgiving of it. Mm-hmm. I actually was okay with the humor in this one. Now, one of the characters in the next film, which I'm sure we'll get to, that's another story, but yeah, that's for that time.
We'll get to that one. What about you, Glenn? You sighed when you heard about Herbert Lom. Do you think that just was a waste of a veteran actor? I mean, was he just needing money?
Not just a veteran actor. I mean, this is, you're talking about Chief Inspector Charles Dreyfus from the Pink Panther movies.
I know.
I mean, this is like right after those movies. I mean, Curse of the Pink Panther was in 83, I think. So just 2 years earlier. I think it was a tremendous waste of his talent. Because the role, I don't know, it was too cornball.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when side-by-side with a more, I guess, sinister, John Rhys-Davies role, you know, because he was like the, it's as Scott put it, you know, he's the Colonel Klink, whereas John Rhys-Davies, you know, is just, he's the villain.
Yeah.
Davies really was kind of playing that, I felt like he was playing that villain straight. Like, you could have probably taken his villain out of this campy, cheesy film and put it in an actual Indiana Jones film and it would have fit because of the way Davies actually performs. I mean, he makes the most of this role, you can tell. You know, and he's the hardest guy to kill, too. I did like that shtick at the end. Yes, this is a spoiler room, like we always remind you, folks, there are spoilers. At the end, I just got a kick out of his character just kept coming back. I thought that was hilarious, because it was fitting for his character. You could almost see it because they set him up as such a badass.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's one of the things that got me, too. I was watching this going... Okay, they're trying to take Alan Quartermain and parody tongue-in-cheek poke fun, ha-ha, at Indiana Jones, who took on Nazis. So we're going to have Alan Quartermain take on Germans in the 1900s who aren't actually Nazis yet, but they sure as hell are acting and dressing and looking like the part.
It's World War I time, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, even though that was supposed to be like the Great War, the war to end all wars, it's still one of the most horrific and bloodiest wars ever fought. It's just terrifying if you ever look at the history of it. But let's face it, let's put these two figures besides. Adolf Hitler, Kaiser Wilhelm, you know? Just in canon fashion, it's still the also-ran of brutal megalomaniacal
Germans. Now, speaking of canon, though, you know, they really did put a lot of effort into this film, though. Maybe not so much in script, but in production. I mean, if you look at the stunts that they have in here, am I off, Glenn? But, I mean, they have some actually serious stunts, not just the cheesy green screen airplane scene. But there's actual stunts and explosions going on, and massive cast as well. Did the production value seem high for kind of the film that it was?
I don't think it felt high. It just, I thought it was all right. I mean, it's really high, again, compared to the sequel.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I thought it was all right. It's nothing that wowed me. I thought it was just typical for this type of film.
It was $11 million in $1985, I believe.
According
to IMDb, King Solomon's Mines budget was $12,500,000.
It
grossed. It grossed opening weekend $5 million altogether. After its run, looks like it grossed $15 million altogether. For back then. So it wasn't a huge bust. I mean, no, they didn't make the double their money back, but, you know, it was all right, and the budget of $12,500 had to go to that cast for the African tribe scene alone. I mean, how many people did they have in that scene of the cannibals? That was insane. Oh,
yeah. I mean, yeah. Come on. You paid those guys, what, like $1?
Yeah, both movies had a great array of extras, though. It's true. They were probably horribly paid, as Glenn said. But yeah,
I'm willing to. It's a lot of Hollywood movies. I mean, those extras aren't, if they're not speaking roles, they're not paid at all.
Yeah.
One, you know, you'll see the. I mean, when Public Enemy shot in Milwaukee, they just put a call out for extras. Hey, want to be an extra? Pays nothing, but you get to be in a movie.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's the age-old, it doesn't pay anything, but hey, you get exposure.
Yeah, you get to be the guy way in the back on the top of the hill.
You know,
in King Solomon's Mines, where you're like, wow, there's guys all the way back there.
Hey, are you a white man? Want to play an Arab?
That's the next film.
Oh, wow, yeah. No. Well, should we mention this right now or later, that both these films kind of had quite a bit of, you know, one thing that didn't seem to get updated too much was the old-timey racism a lot of these movies.
I noted that. One of the lines they drop is cheap-suited camel jockey.
Yeah.
I mean, I listen, they go, wow, okay, we are definitely in the 80s here.
Yeah, and he calls him a towel-headed something or other at one point, like, wow! Yeah. And plus, you know, you have, basically, it's like, you got like also like the white heroes and stuff, and you have the evil German, evil Turk, and all the black people are pretty expendable in the movie.
Like, I know, right?
And it's like, you're kind of watching this, you know, with a, you know, adult's eyes, you know, and everything, and you're like, whoa. They couldn't have updated that.
Yeah, well, you know, it is mid-80s, though, so you've got that mid-80s mentality. Now, what threw me, though, for this film was the jump, though. You had actually a very decent, I think, fight scene. I do like the whole train sequence, in all honesty. I think the train sequence is actually one of the best parts of this film. And then you follow it up right after with probably the most horrific thing in our film, which is the plane scene. Which is horribly composited.
Bad blue screen.
Oh my god. I mean, what'd you think, the jumping between, like, you'd go from a great thing like the train scene, which is actually directed and edited well and everything, the fight and everything, and then you go to the plane scene. I mean, really, what were they thinking? Was it really a budgetary thing, you think, to where the plane scene, oh, we'll just do this in post?
Blue screen in that scene, though, I was even commenting, like, wow, that's really terrible blue screen. And there's a couple other spots in the movie where you see, that's really terrible blue screen. It all looks golden compared to the next film. I was like, wow, that's one of the worst blue screen. You can actually see Sharon Stone's hair is blue right now.
What about the effects for you, Glenn? Not just a train and plane scene, but how about that, you know, when they get to King Solomon's mines? I mean, you get bits in there that look like they've put a lot of thought into it, and then there's bits in there that look like they were added afterwards because they had a few, like, $5 left in their pocket.
Yeah, if it had been one way or the other the whole way through, it wouldn't be as bad, but the fact that you jump from pretty good effects and sets to, you know, this, hey, look what I found at a garage sale for $2, let's just throw it in there, and, you know, my nephew, you know, knows how to use Commodore 64, so we can just do the special effects stuff for it, right?
He's
save
got
some money there, and instead we'll go all for lobster with what we're supposed to be spending on this. So when I see movies where there's stuff like that, I don't know if it's a budget thing or it's kind of like they reach a point where they're just kind of like, you know, fuck it. You know what? Whatever. You know, me and Dick and Sharon are all going out for some lobster dinners, some champagne.
Yeah, I want to know how much of the budget went towards the one fire graphic they used when they were dumping people into the pit in King Solomon's mine when they get there. It was like the same fire effect.
It's the same effect that they would use whenever they would blow up Fu Manchu's lair in all those Christopher Lee films.
Yeah.
It's the transparent fire just coming up.
Well, how about... Was it me, or did it feel like they ripped off the Death Star explosion once they blew up King Solomon's mine? Did you notice that? It felt like the original explosion from the Death Star overlaid on top of the King Solomon mine.
I'm going to have to go back and rewatch that part then.
That explosion looked very similar, you know. I almost was like, I wonder... You know, but you got to give this film props. They were also trying. It's weird because you almost get the feeling they were making a few statements about the colonization of Africa with Germany as well, with some of the dialogue in here. Did you feel like that? I mean, I know it's campy and cheesy and all that, but underlying, it felt like they were trying to carry a little bit of message with how Germany handled, you know, the whole Africa thing. Maybe it was just the whole racism thing in general that was getting me, but what do you guys think? You think there's any other statement in there, or were they just weren't even, I'm giving it way too much deep thought?
I think you're giving it too much thought.
No, Mark, no. I always love to read stuff like that in there. And you know what? I honestly did see a lot more sophistication in this film than when I was younger, but no, I think this one was just trying to be a campy knockoff of Indiana Jones, and I for one actually found it to be an entertaining one too. So
well, this one definitely was, and you know, I've seen some comments. I was doing some research and stuff online, and I saw some people making fun of the soundtrack. But I actually think this is one of Jerry Goldsmith's more interesting soundtracks that he did.
This thing
was used for like every adventure movie trailer for the next like 7 years afterwards.
Yeah,
this theme
and
from
most
this,
of the next film.
Most of the next film, we'll get to that in a minute. But what did you guys think of the music for this film? I thought it was actually decent. It was one of his last full orchestral ones before he started using the whole synthesizer shit.
I think the music was fine. I think the music was obviously they were trying to do. In that, it was also kind of a copy of the Indiana Jones film.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, they kind of tried to go that same kind of route with that, you know. Except the fact that they had the dramatic music too often.
They played his theme an awful lot, didn't they?
An awful lot.
I love his score to this movie, though. And if you notice, a lot of times when they're going up against the Germans, like in the plane scene, they'll play on Colonel, whatever the fuck his name was, they'll play on his love of Wagner and actually use mm-hmm. Wagner motifs. Like there's a little bit of kind of a Ride of the Valkyries thing while they're on the plane, mm-hmm. which is kind of a recalling of his love of Wagner. And let's face it, also probably a little bit of a joke about Apocalypse Now, you know, because they are tossing bombs down on there while they're flying, you know. So, you know, and I thought Jerry Goldsmith's score here was great, actually. Sure. I loved it.
Yeah, me too. I really enjoyed the music to it. It's actually one of the higher points, even though they did kind of overuse the theme, but that's Jerry Goldsmith. Will Smith. One thing he could do great is make a great theme. His scoring in general for a film wasn't as always great, but let me tell you, if you need a hero theme, Goldsmith could whip a memorable one up in no time. And he definitely has it in here, and they definitely use it often.
At times it's like, hey, he's punching bad guys, theme, awesome. Hey, he's drinking a cup of coffee, theme. I don't know. Taking a nap.
he's kissing
with grandma.
He's kissing Sharon Stone, and they're still playing the theme.
Well, they probably knew what kind of STD she'd be carrying later on, so it's like... that's
not very nice to say.
No, it's not. But you know what? But you know what? Police Academy 4.
it's not nice to say, but you know what? She can scratch her infested vagina with $1,000 bills.
Yes, she can. Well, apparently this did get nominated, I think, for a couple Razzies. Oh no, that was the next one. Maybe it was this one too.
I hate the Razzies though. They're just trendy. They will go with whatever's like trendy to hate at the moment. They don't necessarily even see the movie, and they always are just like they always like coming up with a catty pun more than anything else. Case in point, to show you how they don't stand the test of time. Yes, last year maybe we did agree on the worst movie of the year, movie 43. First Razzies, Kubrick was nominated for worst director.
Yeah,
so screw him.
And King Solomon's Mines would later go on to be remade with a Patrick Swayze as Alan Quartermain in a miniseries. I have not seen that yet. That was in 2004. Makes me wonder how they played that one off. I think we. Anybody had any final thoughts with King Solomon's Mines? I mean, I think we pretty well covered this film. It's not exactly deep film. It's tongue in cheek. The jokes were all right. Any final thoughts with King Solomon's Mines before we move on to the other one?
Glad they blew it up.
Well, they did I like the shtick with the diamond and how his African buddy ended up being the tribe king, which he kind of saw coming. But
that is in the book and the movie.
That was in both the book and the movie. So
and it was in the 50s one, I know too. So I didn't see the third one in the 30s, so I don't know how they changed that one. So.
Oh, but any more final thoughts, Glenn, or is you glad you watched it and it was over and done with, right?
Yeah, I mean that. I remembered parts from when I watched it as a kid, because this was back in the days of the early days of Showtime and HBO, where they showed they got the rights to a movie and played the fuck out of it.
At least because
there was nothing else to watch, I watched the hell out of this stuff. So
three times a day, I think they showed them. I know
at least.
I know the person who used to babysit me when I was in fifth grade, they had HBO, which was a really big deal because we didn't have cable. So they had HBO, and you'd see the movie in the morning when I left for school, and when I returned from school, it'd be the same movie.
Yep.
So they spanned them about 6 or 8 hours apart.
Plus back then, none of these stations were running the R-rated films until nighttime. If you had something where this movie was PG-13, I think the next one was just PG, okay, we got to get some daytime play out of these things. Late night, that's when we can show the boobs, but this time we got to do this.
Yes. This one was
daytime, nothing but Alan Quartermain and Short Circuit 2.
Yeah. Right.
Any final thoughts for you, Scott, on King Solomon's Mines before we move on?
I think I've said it. I mean, it's a campy little knockoff, but you know what? I like campy little knockoffs, so I've done this one.
Yeah, and I did too. I liked how it was done. I think part of that has to be because of the director. I mean, the director that you had for this was not a slacker. He wasn't just some toss-off director. So I think he made the most of a script that he had. And they did what they could with it. I'm sure there was a lot of producer input into this film of wanting to make it a cheesy thing. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say, I'm glad you brought that up. I was just going to say, J. Lee Thompson is one of those directors who had a really great early career, and in the 80s, he did wind up working for Canon, where he didn't do his best work. A lot of the people didn't. A lot of the, if you look at a lot of these films, they were kind of under Menachem Golan and Yoram Globus. They all kind of, their work kind of blended together. Mm-hmm. But, and so, you know, you could see, you know, J. Lee Thompson wasn't supposed to do Charles Bronson films, but he wound up doing them. But you know what? He did a lot better with this film than a lot of these other directors did, you know, and so there's very few directors that escaped this unscathed. You know, I think John Frankenheimer was just fine after Canon, you know, but he did. But I think J. Lee Thompson did a really good job with this film, knowing by that point, oh, this is what I've kind of gotten myself into. But right now I'm overseas and they can't watch me over my shoulder. So I'm actually going to try to make this a good one. That's what it felt like to me.
And that's the feeling I get. I get an honest treatment that the director really was trying to make something out of an, you know, completely ridiculous script and the direction they were going. You know, Richard Chamberlain needed another jacuzzi. That's why he was doing it. And Sharon Stone was just trying to get some feature films under her belt. So, and John Ray Davies was just trying to show he could be more than just a extra or a B-list type actor, you know, or a supporting role. And I think they all accomplished that well. Now we're going, I think, to move to the second film. Prepare yourselves, folks, because we're going to cover Alan Quatermain and Lost City of Gold. Now, this film, along with King Solomon's Mines, were actually shot back-to-back, which didn't happen often back then. Now it seems to be commonplace, but they actually shot both these films back-to-back. The only problem is, I think King Solomon's Mines got the bulk of the budget.
Yeah.
And they had extra money left over, so they said, hey, why don't we shoot this second film right away while we're in Africa? We've got the cast and crew here already. We'll just fly a couple people in and do a second film. Now, Alan Quatermain and the Lost City of Gold was released, I believe, a year later after King Solomon's Mines. And in this one, we get, okay, prepare yourselves, folks. Alan Quatermain is teaming up again with Jesse Houston, which was Sharon Stone's character in the first one. They're actually engaged in this one. And they go looking for the Lost City of Gold because Alan Quatermain's brother was looking for it. And so they go into the wilds of Africa to look for his brother and also the Lost City of Gold. Sounds exciting, doesn't it? That actually sounds like a decent follow-up to the first one.
Oh, I can't wait to see that movie.
I can't wait.
I saw this one instead, though.
And Scott, let's start with you. Initial reactions.
Well, you know, yeah, they had budget cuts, so the special effects are a lot worse. The blue screen's a lot worse. A lot worse. The direction is by Gary Nelson this time, I think. The same guy who did Freaky Friday and the Black Hole.
Yes.
He's not as good behind it. And you have some really awful miscasting this time. Whereas you could even forgive Herbert Lom's, okay, he's going campy. This one features Henry Silva in one of the most hilarious Henry Silviest films roles that he's ever done. You got
This is CNN.
Joe, thank you, James Earl Jones. But just in case you thought James Earl Jones brought dignity to every role he was given, this is the antidote. And, you know, then you have Cassandra Peterson, Elvira, in a non-speaking role, which is tragic. And, of course, you have Swarma.
Swarma, yes. We will get to him in a minute. We'll get to him. So,
I have a lot of hate for Swarma.
Glenn, your initial reactions of Lost City of Gold after seeing King Solomon's Mines.
All right, Alan Quatermain and the City of Gold put on the top of a hill where everyone can see it. it was definitely a letdown from the, you know, the mediocre bar that King Solomon Mine had set. It's like watching that fat kid in your class trying to do that chin up, and it's like you want them to be able to do it, you can't, And it's like you're trying not to laugh at them because you know they're trying and you know that they're having a hard go of it. I may or may not have been that fat kid, but still. Actually, I was not, but.
Oh, well, I was.
Every day after school. Any amount of respect that they had for the franchise, they just said, yeah, no. Nah.
Screw it.
Screw it. Just,
you know, it's funny because I watched this, you know, I grew up with these films, and after seeing King Solomon's Mines, it took a little while, but you had Lost City of Gold, and I didn't think it was that bad when I was younger. Watching them now, back to back, Lost City of Gold makes King Solomon's Mines look really, really good. I mean, and that's saying too much, but really, this film felt like it was such a toss-off extra, hey, let's just do this while we're here sort of thing, that it was painful. Again, it was released by Cannon Group. This time, MGM bought the rights to distribute this one.
And well, they got a lot of the Cannon stuff.
Yeah. And while we did mention it before, it was Gene Quintano who wrote both the King Solomon's Mines and this one. I think he got liquored up after writing King Solomon's Mines and just tossed Lost City of Gold together.
Well, you know, the before he did change.
You know, before he went on to do the Police Academy films, because yes, the characters in general do change. I mean, one thing I gotta admit with this, and tell me guys if I'm totally off, did Alan Quartermain seem, not the movie, but the character, seem more serious in this one than he did in King Solomon's Mines? He did, but
here's the thing, is that I think there may have even been, aside from the Swarma character, which I'm sure we'll get to, I think there may have even been less comedy in this film, aside from that, than in King Solomon's Mines. But the comedy that was there was so misplaced. Mm-hmm. In the first film, you could see Alan Quatermain's there. It's Quatermain, guys. Nobody, and it's okay because nobody in the movies pronounces it right either. But yeah. it's Quatermain, not Quartermain. But in the other movies, he's, you know, trying to wisecrack his way out of danger and stuff. In this film, like first like 10 minutes, he sees a friend of his die a horrible death,
yeah,
and then says, well, it wasn't the fever that killed him. Is now the best time for a one-liner? Really? You just watched one of your best friends die a horrible death. That is so not... I wish they would have like expanded that scene for about 5 more seconds so you could just see the crowd like part around him, so everybody around him could just go, dude... not cool. So they changed, and also Jessie becomes, she wasn't quite as whiny in the first one. She was still whiny, but not like this. This one starts out where he's got to like beg and plead for her to understand that he's trying to find out if his brother is alive or dead, and she's all whining, well, what about my needs? Like, fuck your needs! My brother! You know?
My brother's lost in the woods. His buddy just showed up and got killed in our bedroom.
I know!
But she bought boat tickets, damn it!
I couldn't get that. I was like, and, you know, it would often alternate, because, like, sometimes Sharon Stone's character, and this is actually something interesting I never noticed before, is that sometimes she shows that she's the archaeologist of the story, not Quatermain. He's like a big game hunter, but she's the archaeologist, and sometimes she'll show her know-how, and sometimes she'll be able to fight her way out of stuff, I'm like, oh, cool! And then other times she's just whining and screaming, so it's like this very bipolar treatment of the character. It annoyed me.
What about you, Glenn? Did Quartermain seem different? And did Sharon Stone just get more annoying character?
She did get more annoying, I thought, in this one. And that whole scene I'm just like, where she's like, you know, well, what about us? What am I? I'm like, well, you're nothing at the moment because you're the person telling me that us sailing to America to get married is more important than my brother being alive.
Yeah.
That's not a good foundation for a relationship, is that you're, fuck your family, I want to get married. I don't care if your friends are dead. I mean, they've been gone a while. They've been gone so long.
Yeah, they've been gone so long, Line. I'll agree with that. What Scott said, though, her character was inconsistent. You know, at least she was at least somewhat damsel in distress the whole time in the first one. In this one, they didn't know whether or not to make her a strong female role or put her the damsel in distress because, yeah, you know, they're in that horrible tunnel scene, which I wanted to bring up to you guys because they're in this corridor, folks. They're hunting through Africa. Alan finally is heading off to find the lost city of gold, and Sharon Stone's character, Jesse, is following behind him because she feels he needs her after all. That's what she tells herself anyway. And they find this corridor lined with either side of stones. And suddenly, Jesse remembers she's an archaeologist and throws out some really cool, strong, like she knows what she's talking about, facts. But then later on, she's not doing anything. But this corridor, guys, did you notice the floor bounces as they walked out it?
Yep.
Yes.
We've got Swarma, who we'll talk about in a minute, but he's kind of this Indian guy who's a con artist trying to play off as a fortune teller who tags along with Alan because he wants to get the gold. And he finds this medallion in the wall, and he pushes it, which opens up the ground to swallow the people. The problem is you knew it was coming because the minute they step on the ground, which should have been solid, you see the boards. I mean, like, you could tell they were physically trying to step where it was supported because there must have been some...
Watch out, Jesse. That patch of grass is a little loose.
But, you know, it wasn't elaborate. That means there was actually some depth below them. You know, was this probably the weakest, and that's saying a lot, the weakest scene in this film or one of them?
Oh, no. No, the weakest scene was when they were in the actual mountain cave there, and they were underground, and you could tell they were on the movie set just miming rowing the boat because the blue screen was so terrible. And it was so obviously trying to be kind of like the rail car chase in Temple of Doom. And it just wasn't that because, yeah, but you know what? It actually felt like they actually had a real set and a real thing going on in Temple of Doom. And yeah, I know they probably had like many times this budget, but still... It looked so bad, and you could practically see them like on there with a blue screen and like stagehands out right, just off screen, like rocking the boat.
Not just blue screen. Yeah. With the whole thing with the big giant pillar of fire out of the water, they used horrible animated like puppetry or whatever.
Claymation type.
Yeah. Claymation where they're like so the movie was so jerky. I'm like, wow, was that heat miser I just saw go across the screen there? And what's going on with this?
See, I found this is all unintentional, but I did find all these things very funny and endearing and entertaining. But it was completely unintentional this time. It's not even like the first one where it's just trying to be a campy send-up. This was all unintentional.
So the ground opening up and eating our heroes wasn't the worst scene. You would say it's probably the whole boat kayak.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I caught during this whole thing was at one point, they're paddling the wrong way. They're moving forward, but the way they're paddling, they should have been going backwards. Both Sharon Stone and Chamberlain paddling the wrong way. And what I think it is I think it's the same shot because they get a similar angle later that they just used and reversed it, I think, to try to make it seem like two different shots. I'm not sure, but yeah. And, you know, going back to that corridor scene, though, where they're trying to crawl up out of it, you know, it seemed like it was closing a lot faster than they were climbing up to get out of it. Was,
oh yeah,
just me.
Oh yeah, it's like well, the thing like starts to seal, and they're like, I'm like, whoa, they're just starting climbing up now. They're not gonna. Oh wait, what am I saying? Of course they're gonna make it.
And he puts his leg up and the ground bounces. I'm like,
your legs! Get your legs up or you might get a sliver from that wood.
Your legs! That's expensive styrofoam, you'll damage it.
And the person who triggered our hallway scene was Swarma. Let's talk about this man who is probably the most offensive character.
Exit over.
Yes, go ahead, Glenn. Why don't you talk a little bit about Swarma?
Played by Robert Donner, I believe.
Yes.
Who is Exodor from the Mork and Mindy series. Actually, he's also an established...
Oh, my God! That was him!
playing this kind of cross between the whole Indian, holy man and the Swedish chef. Somewhere in between the two...
That's about right, yeah.
It's one of those roles where I'm like, oh man, the 80s were just so fucked up with that shit. Because, you know, they have like this one here where you got, you know, it's like, hey, let's get a white dude from New York, because that's where he's from New York City,
yep,
to play an Indian holy man.
And they put him in brown face.
This ranks up there with Aaron Gray's dad, whose name I forget right now, being the Korean guy in Remo Williams.
Yes.
Oh, Joel Gray, yeah. Joel Gray, yeah.
Yes, because, you know, in California they couldn't find an Asian actor.
Well, it's just like they're in Africa and they couldn't find a Hindu guy, actor to play the role. I mean, come on.
They got Bollywood right around the corner, you know.
I know, they couldn't grab, because that role really wasn't anything meaningful. They could have grabbed anyone. You didn't need any in-depth actor to play that role. They could have got any.
Maybe there was no Indian actors that were willing to sell out their race like this guy was, because let's face it, he's not just an Indian. He is the most ridiculous stereotype since Mickey Rooney checked in, tried to order breakfast at Tiffany's. Okay? he was so amazingly... basically, take the... You know how Ashton Kutcher got in trouble recently for mimicking an Indian guy on his... Kind of like, that looks subtle and nuanced compared to this performance.
Yeah.
Mike Myers... looked subtle and nuanced compared to this performance.
So, speaking of characters in here, then we have someone who, at this point in his career, is actually on the rise, a known actor. He played the voice of Darth Vader in two Star Wars films, I believe, at this point. And we get James Earl Jones playing a Highlander... African guy? I mean, it looked like he was walking around in a kilt, but he's got this huge axe, which wouldn't be so bad, but this thing had to be... Was this the dullest axe you ever saw, Glenn?
Okay, that doesn't bother me, because traditionally, a large battle axe like that would not have been sharp.
Oh, okay.
But the thing is that a character in Africa wouldn't have a traditional battle axe. Because a weapon like that, the reason it's not sharp in general is because you're going against people wearing armor. If you take a very sharp blade and hit a piece of metal with it, you chip your blade. And on top of the fact that just you have a big heavy piece of metal and you whack someone with it, doesn't matter if it's sharp or not, it's going to hurt them and fuck them up a lot. The whole axe didn't make any sense. It's not in the least bit type of weapon some African tribesman guy would have. But well, I guess they came up with that altar scene and then said, well, we got to have something big enough. And, well, how about a hammer? Oh, a hammer's dumb. Let's give him an axe. Okay. He's got a big, giant axe.
It's somehow enough to split that stone thing in half and I'm still not sure exactly what the hell they did at the end with the axe. All I know is that Alan Quartermain could catch the thing with ease like it was light as a feather, and yet it did that.
Well, how about let's back up. It was after the canoe scene that was horrible that you had to try to get through without laughing, and because of the heat, it made him pass out. But they run across this tribe of people who, I swear, the head of this tribe was the same guy who was the head of the cannibal tribe. Looked like the same actor, but I couldn't find it in the credits. But they launch all these arrows at their one canoe. There's a whole line. I mean, this line of tribe cover the entire width of the river. You have one canoe. And yet, with the magic axe that James Earl Jones carries, he can spin it in front of him and chop all the arrows except for one, which hits Alan Quartermain in the special vest underneath the shirt, which I think Peter Jackson and Tolkien ripped
off. Thank you. And I was going to say something about you know, if all those orcs couldn't hit those barrels.
This is true. The whole magic axe thing, yeah, he could spin it and it could cut all the arrows. And then Alan Quartermain, for those of you who haven't seen this film, has this vest underneath his shirt that really does look like it was ripped off from Tolkien. I mean, complete to the silver shimmer. I don't know if Peter Jackson modeled his prop in his films after this, but it was basically couldn't be pierced by any sharp object, and so they would just bend. So when the natives see the spear hit Mr. Alan Quartermain and not kill him, they get spooked and run away because of this magical material he has under his shirt. And if it just didn't look like it was ripped off, you look at it, it's like, yeah, you know, somebody borrowed that from somewhere. Which it comes into play later on when Swarma, when they eventually meet the priest, who, as Scott Davis put it, let's move on to that character, Mr. Henry Silva, playing this priest who's got control. They find the lost white tribe of Africa, which is in a city that is quite visible from a plane, so I'm not quite sure how it was lost. And they come upon the tribe, and they find brother, and there's this priest that apparently has a hold over the people of the lost city of gold, played by Henry Silva.
Who I'm happy to say, has been using his share of Soul Glow.
Glenn, was this guy the embodiment of every stereotypical bad villain priest that had come before him?
Oh my gosh, was he ever. It's I don't know, he was part Don King, part part the bad priest from Beastmaster. I don't know what. It's like it was so lazy, the writing for this. So
it was, wasn't
horribly
it?
Lazy, where it's just like, this guy's like, you know, he's got everybody, you know, under this grasp of fear. The dude has like 8 guards.
Yeah.
And then like this army that like lives outside of the city. I'm like, really?
And runs away really easy, yeah.
The dozens and dozens and dozens of people who live here can't overpower him and his 8 guards?
Yeah.
Apparently not. And I think part of it because everyone in Africa is stupid. I don't mean in real life. I mean, I'm not saying...
No, including
the white people who live there. Because, first of all, I'm gonna jump all the way back to the beginning. The whole where dude gets killed, you know, and not from the infection or whatever it was. Do they not have... Who just sits there and thinks, you know what? We don't have locks on our doors, and this guy was just chased here by a bunch of guys with knives. We'll be fine.
Yeah, they leave him alone.
We're in a city with a guy who wants to kill us. I'll leave my gun and my magic protective vest just tucked under my pillow in my room.
Look, they gave him a mosquito tent. I don't know what more you want.
All the characters in here, not just the people who are the folks from Africa, but every character in here is dumb. I mean, Alan Quartermain is he? And Alan Quartermain in this one, unlike the other one where he was kind of jokester dumb. He's just dumb in this one until he needs to not be, and then suddenly, oh, I've got an idea. But yeah, I just you're
we
right.
We don't have any weapons, but we have gold, which yeah. doesn't help you. Well, we can make enough weapons here. You can't make weapons from gold. Gold is this off metal. It would make a terrible weapon.
Oh, but you know, I have no knowledge of like that kind of stuff, and even I knew that. I was like, "Wait, you can't make you can't make weapons out of gold." Until, of course, they show what their great weapon is out of gold, which is actually dropping bricks, which actually doesn't seem to bother them that much. They're just like kind of like, "Ow, quit it."
Yeah.
Well, and then you get the whole thing with the vest where Alan Quartermain happened to find enough vests for all the main people because, you know, screw the rest of the people of the town. At least our three main characters who are getting speaking parts are going to live because they get to wear more special armor that Alan found in the catacombs or whatever of the Lost City of Gold. And suddenly these tribesmen who know it's a vest... Who know, they saw, they run away scared because they still have the power. And I'm just like, really? They're that dumb? You know, and they weren't funny dumb, they were just dumb. You know, I mean, that's what's bad thing is some of these films you can get kind of the funny dumb, like the scene that you get where the tribes, the king of the tribes or whatever, challenges Alan to this test. They gotta break a stone with their head. Yes, this is the test. This is what this chief of this army...
Nasta.
Yes, this is what he challenges Alan Quartermain to. Here, break stone with your head.
Well, you know, what I love is that he did it and... It's the one. It's probably was my favorite line of the movies because Alan Quartermain turns around and says, "How does somebody figure out they can do that?" I like that. That was like almost like the thing where they just like left the script and said, "Huh?"
Yeah, I think that was an ad lib by Richard Chamberlain because that was actually well written and timed. And
it was.
I don't think that was included at all. You know, and no one sees him, Glenn, am I out? No one notices him putting the dynamite under the table.
Yeah.
To blow it up.
And lighting it with what?
I don't know. A lighter, I think?
A rock.
He had? a rock? I don't know. That whole scene, it was like, well, this is just random. We'll just let these army guys in and let them challenge Alan. And, yep, that's the end of it. Okay, well, I guess he blew up the stone. We'll leave. And I'm like, what? The whole thing just had these random events going on. You know, and I will admit, getting to Silva's character, the priest, he does this thing, folks, where he has this deal where he's made gold people. And apparently at first he was a sculptor and was sculpting gold people, but that took too long. So he hangs people upside down and dips them in the vat of gold. And this is like the one shining moment where I actually liked this villain. I'm like, okay, this is kind of cool. I could, you know, this gives him actual a feel like a villain role where he's dipping guys in gold. But they never really do anything with that, nor do they do anything with the whole sacrifice thing. Were there a lot of loose end ideas in this film?
Mm-hmm.
Would you guys agree that there were, where it looks like they started with something and then, we're done?
I mean, isn't that just like a perfect commentary on what the film is? I mean, where it's like, you know... Yeah, he used to be, like, we're artists, we're professionals, we're filmmakers, and we could make this really good, interesting adventure film, but it just takes too long. Let's just, you know, there's, like, all these plot threads and stuff. You know what? Just sweep them under. Who cares? Just get the damn thing out there.
And we're good to go.
We're going to release this in January.
I said, just dip Richard Chamberlain some celluloid and we're all set. Done.
Now, I like Richard Chamberlain. You know, of course, you know, I wasn't the audience for the Thornbird, so I never saw that. Never got around to seeing Shogun. But you know what? Screw Matt Damon. Richard Chamberlain is still my favorite Jason Bourne. So
sure. Yeah, he did.
His Bourne Identity miniseries was freaking awesome, dude. It was awesome.
A great thing that also proves how 80s the movie is that magic vest he wears is obviously very, very low cut, because yeah. Chamberlain always has his shirt like the first like 18 buttons open.
Yeah. It's like, why don't you put that over your heart rather than not just, like, you know, your tummy?
He's got to show off his chest hair. There's nothing... Yeah. In the 1980s, there was nothing manly. Or 70s, 80s, nothing manlier than chest hair. Let that hang out.
I would have been so upset if I just was born a few decades earlier there. Nobody wants this now.
they had that in the first one, too, where it just... I noticed that, where it's like, oh, there's a scene, an excuse for him to have his shirt open. Look, there it is. Lost City of Gold, too, one of those random plot threads they had was this whole sister thing where there were two queen sisters. One had a speaking role. The other one was Elvira, who just stood there and looked pretty. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was literally her role. In a gold corset. But
now, she did that very well, I will say, but still, yeah, it's disappointing because I liked Elvira.
She did, and I totally forgot she was in this, and I'm like, oh, okay, cool. And then they get to the scene where she comes in the throne room, and she doesn't say a word. And she doesn't say a word in the next scene. And pretty soon, she's not saying a word in any scene.
She does kind of like moan or scream in like the last scene, but that's about it.
Well,
yeah.
Where they're hanging over the pit of gold where they get dropped in. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, folks. And then there's that finale, as Glenn mentioned earlier, with the magic axe, which this is how Alan finally decides to kill the bad guys, is we need a weapon. So he takes the axe, which he could grab with ease, even though this is supposed to be this heavy pound axe that only James Earl Jones can carry, goes on top of this huge golden lion head that's above the temple, and starts, I have no idea what. It felt like a scene that was ripped off of Black Roses, but instead of a guitar, he had an actual axe, and he's hitting the lion's head, and there's really bad electrical effects, and apparently it starts melting the lion's head into liquid gold. It heats it enough so the hot gold comes roaring down the front of the temple to help protect the people, because nobody's going to go walk under the molten gold that is pouring off of the lion. What the hell?
I'm glad I'm not the only one, because I was watching this and I was just like, okay, am I really just that dumb? I mean, I know I'm not the sharpest tool in the drawer, but wow, I don't understand what's going on right now.
Would you say that was like the most odd, just random solution ever for a hero to come up with? Out of all the options they had, he does this.
Yes, I think a better option would just, you know, hey, I got this giant axe. I'll just smack Henry Silva in the face with it and kill him.
That would certainly get the job done, I think.
But no, they get into a fight with Silva, a sword fight, which is probably the lamest sword fight, and that's saying a lot, but this was a really lame sword fight. And he offs Henry Silva by doing the old, oh, press against my sword, press against my sword, oh, I dodge out of the way, and he walks under the hot molten gold, which looks like oatmeal when it's being poured on Henry Silva.
And it makes him, like, just stop and freeze immediately.
Yeah, he doesn't scream.
It's not like you, like, get, like, a taste of that, and you jump out of the way and try to, like, jump in the water or something, which we know is, like, right there. Like, yeah, whoa, woo, like do like a Three Stooges deal. No, he just stands there, ah! You know?
Well, as everyone knows, molten gold, when it touches human skin, solidifies instantly.
Yes.
Well, it was a cold night, so, you know, it was raining, apparently, or there was a storm, or lightning, or something. I don't know what energized the axe, but God, you know, when the first one kind of had at least the novelty and everything to it, and then you get this one, which, like, I want to mention real quick, we mentioned the music before in the first one. If you like that soundtrack, you don't have to buy Alan Quartermain and the Lost City of Gold soundtrack, because they used majority of the music from the first one in this one. That's right. Out of the hour and a half movie, they only have a half hour of original music. They literally...
I was fine with that. I was fine with that because, you know, a lot of the films in the old days, you know, their sequels, they did use a lot of the same music and stuff. I'm like, fine, it was a good score. And you could tell when the other score was because it had the Canon Synsonic drum toy set, you know. Like, okay, that's the new score, yeah. They do that a lot, though. I mean, I was reading it's kind of an aside, but in that new book, Empire of the Bees, Richard Band flat out says, if you watch all the Puppet Master movies, he uses the same music. I've only written about 15 minutes of new Puppet Master music since the original.
Nice.
So it's kind of like the same thing here, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, Lost City of Gold, the first one wasn't phenomenal, but it showed a little promise, and I think had some effort and time been put into it, they could have made a better sequel, but I think we're both agreement out of the two, and it's a bold statement, this is definitely the weaker of the two films. Because
very bold statement there, buddy, very bold.
But it's true.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, this one was really painful. Guys, Glenn, final thought with Lost City of Gold?
I wish Lost City of Gold were this easy to find. I really do. As bad as it was, hey, I'd take a whole city full of gold, even if it means watch this movie again. And, no, actually I wouldn't. There's not. Never mind, forget that. I don't want gold that bad. I'd rather stay poor and live in a cave than have to watch this again. It's just, it's...
Don't want to put you on the spot. Could you give us a scale of 1 to 10?
Oh, God, this is... It's like a hot gold enema.
Get on, Glenn.
To stay on theme, I guess, you know? You're thinking, hey, free gold! Oh, but it's liquid hot and shoved up my ass. Less good. Although, you know, as we've learned, if it happens, you wouldn't scream out in pain, you would just instantly go and freeze in place.
You wouldn't scream or nothing, you just freeze in place. Scott, last thought on
good old Glenn, he's always good for one of those in a pinch. That's fantastic, man. the weird thing is that even when I was a kid, and even though I only thought that the first King Solomon's Mines was okay, for some reason I had such a hard-on to see this movie when I heard it was coming out. I don't know if it was just because I said, oh, cool, we have another Indiana Jones franchise, you know, or something. But I was really into it, and when it came out, didn't get to see it in the theater. When it came out on video, nobody in the area had it. We were actually visiting my grandpa's lake, and I found it at a drugstore there, and I brought it home. I'm like, we're all doing this tonight, family. And they just gave me so many nasty looks when this was over, and yeah, I can understand why. Mea culpa, Davis family, yeah. it's like you said, it feels like they had just leftover money, and they said, well, we could either come back to Hollywood and spend it on cocaine, or we could just make another movie. And... unfortunately, they chose to make another movie.
Yeah, I totally agree. Alan Quartermain, Lost City of Gold, really felt like a lazy sequel. I mean, if there was ever a prime example of a potential to improve on something that was at least a decent concept in King Solomon's Mines and had some great moments, a potential to grow something from that, they went the real cheap route and just said, we'll just do this. And it ended up being probably the pox on many people's resume. I don't think a lot of people went around after this film, you know, and went, oh yeah, I was in Alan Quartermain in The Lost City of Gold.
Not even the guy in the credits who is billed as Toothless Arab. Not even him.
I don't think even him.
Is one too.
There is a credit like that, yeah, among other. Yeah, this film really was bad and not in a fun way. At least King Solomon's Mines kind of had that nice campy feel. This one really, I have no idea what they were trying to do, and I don't think the filmmakers knew what they were trying to do. In A Lost City of Gold Built of Marble, you know, it's bad, folks, really. If you do, these are on Netflix now, and if you're curious, you like Richard Chamberlain, want to see Sharon Stone's earlier work, you can check them out, but I would say you can see King Solomon's Mines, and your life would be better off not seeing Lost City of Gold, because really there didn't seem to be a whole lot of effort put into this film at all, and it just blows me away the stars that were in Lost City of Gold.
Well, I enjoyed it. I just it was jealous. It's just for I didn't enjoy it for the reasons that they wanted.
Well,
so
yeah.
Like if I was gonna say like, do you recommend the movie? I'd say yeah, I do, but it's not because they did such a great job with it. It's because that it is, you're like, oh my god, look at that fire thing. Oh my yeah. No, Henry Silva, what's that wig?
Gene Simmons wants his wig back. No,
yeah.
He could do it with Runaway with Tom Selleck.
Yeah. Oh my god, if Henry Silva just all of a sudden started singing, I was made for loving you, babe.
But yeah, I mean, I couldn't recommend City of Gold. I would say King Solomon's Mines if you watch both of them. If you need to be a completionist, see Lost City of Gold. Scott says, yeah, it is fun. It does have fun moments, but not for the reasons that it should. You know, out of the two, though, I would say King Solomon's Mines probably your better spent time, because yeah. At least that one is a more complete film. Would you agree, Glenn, if you had to recommend between one of the two?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We're talking about the last hour. There's not a question.
Yeah. So check them out, folks. They're on Instant View. If you do check them out, hey, send us a message on Twitter. We're at the Spoiler Room. You can check us out there. We've got the Spoiler Room Facebook page now where you can go and join and like our page and follow up all the interesting new shows we've got coming up. I've got a number of them planned. Hopefully we can roll these out a little more regularly. And if you have suggestions for the shows, go to the Facebook page and post it there as well. There's some great people, and we do pay attention to feedback. Real quick, gentlemen, why don't you pimp your stuff? Scott, why don't you go first? Where can people find you at when you're not talking here with us about Henry Silva?
Under a rock.
Under a rock. Oh,
but yeah. I have a show on Vimeo and YouTube called Moviocrity, Moviocrity. I can't even spell the goddamn thing. And then I also have a podcast on Podomatic called Cinema Obsession. I'm also a frequent guest of Mark's here. Also I'm on Film Jerks and Astro Radio Z.
Indeed, and big deal, Mr. Bittner, go for it, dude.
You can find me on Twitter at Naked Hobo. You can also find me on YouTube at the B-Movie Bunker. And on Facebook, you can find my short film work at Naked Hobo Productions.
Woo-hoo. Yes, the man, he has got three shorts under his belt now. Hopefully one of them will be showing at a festival soon. We got the Oshkosh Horror Film Festival coming up in a little over a month or so. I hope to maybe do a spoiler room with some people who are involved with that. I'm going to try to get that together because I'd love for you folks to hear about all the fun stuff that the Oshkosh Horror Film Festival is. And you can check out Scott's and Glenn's and everyone who has been on the spoiler room. Check out their links on specialmarkproductions.com. That's my site where I have links for this. I also have links to the podcast where you can download it directly, but we are also on iTunes and Stitcher Radio, where you can find us there and download the episodes there. And again, as I mentioned before, if you do that, please rate them and comment, because that does get us notice, and we just like to hear from what you guys think about out there. So I thank Glenn and Scott for endearing these films with us. Enduring, I should say, these films with myself. They weren't quite as entertaining as I remember when I were younger, at least the second one. That's what happens with age, I guess. So hope you check them out, folks. If you have, leave some feedback. Always glad for your listening. And remember, with the spoiler room, the movies are spoiled, but the conversation is definitely fresh.